Hello. Welcome to OWL Radio's Healthy Living Program. I am Martha Attee. During the next half hour, our topics will include sleep, gum disease and diet, brain cells, weightlifting. But I found an odd topic, for me at least, that I'd like to share with you as a first article. The first article is from Time Magazine, written on March 8, 2019. It's entitled, "Some Anti-Vaxxers Aren't Getting Their Pets Vaccinated. Here's Why That's So Dangerous." Dogs can't get autism, and even if they could, vaccines couldn't cause it. Period. Some anti-vaxxers are increasingly making the same unfounded claims about pets and vaccines that they've been repeating about children and vaccines for the past 20 years, and that is that vaccines are unnecessary, dangerous, and they can cause a form of canine autism along with other diseases. Just as with kids, that may be driving down pet vaccination rates, and the movement, while it is a small group, shows no sign of stopping. In some states in the United States, anti-vax activists have recently agitated to make state laws about mandatory pet vaccinations more lax. The problem is acute in the United Kingdom. In its most recent annual report, Britain's People's Dispensary for Sick Animals surveyed more than 4,600 pet owners and found that in 2018, about 25% of dogs, 2.2 million of them, had not had their necessary vaccinations when they were young. That's roughly on par with rates the last year, which had jumped significantly. The most common reason people gave for not vaccinating their dog, accounting for 20% of responses, was that, quote, "it's not necessary." Whatever the justification, every owner who does not vaccinate a dog contributes to endangering a great many other dogs, too. The figures for pets not receiving primary vaccinations and regular boosters may threaten population-level immunity, so the authors in the report said. The numbers are also high for other pets. 35% of cat owners did not have their kittens vaccinated, and 41% of older cats hadn't received their regular boosters. Almost half of pet rabbits had not been vaccinated when they were young. These increasing trend lines are consistent with what has happened with human vaccine rates after the thoroughly debunked rumors that vaccines can cause autism began, and rates of unvaccinated children have spiked. Indeed, the fear of canine autism, which again does not exist, could be contributing to vaccination refusals. In 2018, Senior Vice President of the British Veterinary Association issued a statement debunking the link between pet vaccination and autism after a British morning show stoked fears on this link and on social media. There is currently no reliable scientific evidence to indicate autism in dogs or a link between vaccination and autism, the president of the Veterinary Association said. Vaccinations save lives and are an important tool for keeping our pets healthy. In the United States, veterinarians and animal advocates are also fighting this type of misinformation. Vaccine resistance may be growing among pet owners here, according to a 2017 article on the industry website American Veterinarian, though at the moment reports are anecdotal and spotty, limited mostly to the trend-setting places like Brooklyn and San Francisco. In an email to Time Magazine, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals wrote, quote, "We are not aware of studies that have documented a change in vaccination rates and in pets. The ASPCA community medicine team alone performs tens of thousands of vaccinations annually for own dogs and cats and rescue animals." But Brett McKenzie, a veterinarian in Los Altos, California, told the American Veterinarian that he has indeed seen pushback from pet owners. Over the last 10 to 15 years, he said, there has been an increase in mostly unfounded concern about vaccine safety for people. And that, I think, has raised people's awareness and level of concern about vaccinations for their pets. Often the concerns the pet owners have are both vague and catastrophic, with vaccines said simply to overwhelm the immune system and leave the animal susceptible to any and all diseases. That creates a neat kind of self-validated reasoning. Any illness the animal contracts, no matter how unrelated to vaccination, can be blamed on it. Like all vaccines, those created for animals do carry some potential side effects, most minor, some more serious but less common. According to the AVMA, the mild ones include fever, decreased appetite, and canine coughing. The more serious ones, which require immediate veterinary care, include swelling of the muzzle, severe coughing, or even collapse. As with all vaccines, however, the risk of remaining unprotected dramatically exceeds the dangers of the shot. There is a huge upside and a tiny downside, so says Nicholas Dodman, Professor Emeritus of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University. The trend in the United Kingdom and the risk of something similar occurring in the United States have vets worried. One thing that contributes to the danger is, paradoxically, that vaccines have been so successful at controlling animal disease that many people have no experience at how terrible those diseases can be, a phenomenon that mirrors anti-vaxxers' cavalier attitude about human diseases like measles or polio. There was a time when I worked in Scotland, says Dr. Dodman, and they didn't vaccinate, and I saw horrible cases of distemper. You see the way the animal suffers, and you would always vaccinate. The most dangerous of all the canine diseases is rabies, which is effectively a death sentence for a dog. Rabies kills, says Amy Nichols, vice president of the Companion Animals Division of the Humane Society. It's incredibly contagious, and a pet that gets it has to be euthanized. In most states, rabies vaccines are required by law, but it's hard for local governments to stay on top of human childhood vaccinations, let alone police people's pets. In two states, anti-vax activists have agitated to loosen state laws, hoping to make it easier to find ways around mandated shots. The first such effort was the Connecticut House Bill 5659, and that was filed in the state legislature in 2017 and would have permitted veterinarians not to administer rabies booster shots on schedule if tests of a dog's blood showed that antibody concentrations were above a certain threshold. The bill would have also allowed the vets to adjust vaccines by administering smaller doses to smaller dogs, for example, though body weight is really not a relevant factor in vaccine efficacy. The Connecticut bill did not pass, but two similar bills were introduced in the New Hampshire state legislature this year. House Bill 331 would have, like the Connecticut bill, allowed veterinarians to administer titer tests to determine the need for a rabies vaccination. House Bill 426 would have allowed pet owners to show proof of such test in obtaining a dog license. Both bills were killed in committee by unanimous votes. But people in the veterinary community don't believe that the anti-vax agitators are going away. My sense from the testimony is that similar bills are being introduced in other states, says Lindsay Hamrick, New Hampshire Senior State Director of the Humane Society of the United States. One thing that could help keep anti-vaccine pet owners in check is that they have a number of half measures anti-vaccine parents don't. Pediatricians are all but unanimous, and correctly so, that children should be vaccinated in full and on time. But with animals, some vets are willing to administer vaccines, other than the rabies vaccine, in smaller doses. And for some vaccines, other than rabies, titer testing may indeed be appropriate to determine if a vaccine can be skipped or delayed. However, Dr. Dodman says it probably costs more to do the titer than to do the shot. The kind of life a particular dog lives may also be relevant. Dogs that go to doggy daycare or visit dog parks or spend a lot of time outside, especially if they swim or wade in fresh rivers or lakes, are at greater risk of infection and in greater need of immunization than dogs that spend a lot of time indoors. The American Animal Hospital Association has an online, lifestyle-based vaccine calculator that addresses this. There is not a dog in the world that has ever enjoyed the feel of a veterinarian's needle, but that pain is incidental and fleeting. The pain of the disease and the shots prevents far worse, far more enduring, and sometimes fatal. Not to vaccinate against these diseases is crazy, says Dr. Dodman. And we will continue reading on the Healthy Living Program. The next article is from the New York Times, and it is dated December 5th, 2018. The title is 6 to 8 hours a night may be the sweet spot for sleep. People who slept more had an increased risk for cardiovascular events and premature death. Getting enough sleep is healthful, but getting too much might not be. Researchers gathered health and lifestyle information, including self-reported sleep data, on 116,632 people in 21 countries. Over 8 years of follow-up, they recorded 4,381 deaths and 4,365 major cardiovascular events. The study in the European Heart Journal found that compared with people who slept 6 to 8 hours a night, those who slept 8 to 9 hours had a 5% increased risk for cardiovascular disease or death. People who slept 9 to 10 hours had a 17% increased risk, and those who slept more than 10 hours increased their risk by 41%. The researchers also found that 9% increased risk in people who slept less than 6 hours, but that difference was not statistically significant. Daytime naps also increased the risk of cardiovascular events, but only in people who slept more than 6 hours a night. The researchers controlled for age, body mass index, physical activity, diabetes, depression, smoking, alcohol consumption, and many other health and behavioral characteristics. Get enough sleep, that is 6 to 8 hours a day, said the lead author, Shuangxi Wang, a doctoral student at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. But if you sleep more than 9 hours a day, you may want to visit your doctor to check your overall health. And that article is written by Nicholas Bacalar in the New York Times, December 5th, 2018. The next article is also from the New York Times, also by Nicholas Bacalar. The title is A Diet to Ward Off Gum Disease. This is from April 4th, 2019. The right diet may improve gum health, a small study has found. German researchers studied 30 people with gingivitis, the inflammation of the gums that can cause redness, swelling, and bleeding. A dentist measured the severity of their gingivitis and their levels of plaque, the bacteria-laden film that builds up on the teeth and can cause gum disease. The researchers took blood samples, and the participants filled out diet questionnaires. Then, the scientists randomized half the group to an anti-inflammatory diet rich in fruit, vegetables, especially legumes, nuts, and fish, and minimized trans fatty acids, sugar, dairy products, and other animal protein. They also took vitamin D supplements. The other half of the study ate their usual diet. Both groups were instructed not to use dental floss or other means of cleaning between teeth. The 8-week study in the Journal of Clinical Periodontology found that, compared to the controls, the diet group had higher vitamin D levels, lost weight, and had significantly less gum bleeding. There were no differences between the groups in plaque accumulation or in blood markers of inflammation. Western diet promotes gingival and other inflammatory diseases, said the lead author, Johann P. Wolber, a dentist and researcher at the University of Freiburg. If your dentist doesn't talk about diet, he's missing one of the causes of gum inflammation. And that article ends there, and that was written by Nicholas Bacalar on April 4th, 2019 from the New York Times. And we'll continue on reading on the Healthy Living program from Owl Radio. The next article is from March 26, 2019, and it is from the Smithsonian Magazine off their website called smithsonian.com. The title is, "The Brain May Actually Keep Generating New Cells Well Into Old Age." The author is Malin Sawley. Scientists have long been divided over whether neurogenesis, which is the process involving the growth of new neurons, continues into adulthood. Last year, a controversial study published in the Journal of Nature posited that humans stop generating new cells in the learning and memory center, called the hippocampus region, long before reaching adolescence. Now, research published in Nature magazine shifts the debate back in favor of late-in-life neurogenesis. The latest findings suggest humans are actually capable of producing fresh cells well into their 90s. Expanding on this Madrid study, the BBC News explains that an analysis of 58 brains belonging to recently deceased individuals aged 43 to 97 revealed a discernible decline in the neurogenesis over time. This drop in new cell production was particularly exacerbated among 45 test subjects age 52 to 97 who had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease prior to their deaths. But the evidence at less severe levels among the 13 brain donors aged 43 to 87 who were neurologically healthy at the time of their death. The fact that new neurons were being made at all bodes well for researchers hoping to capitalize on the manifold benefits of hippocampus cell creation. Karen Weintraub in the Scientific American says such continued growth could help those working to recover from depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, or perhaps even delay the onset of Alzheimer's. Quote, "I believe we are generating new neurons as long as we need to learn new things," unquote, says senior study author Marie Llorens Martín, a neuroscientist at the University of Madrid. And she continues, "And that occurs during every single second of our life." According to Science Magazine's Emily Underwood, the main difference between new research and the 2018 paper discounting adulthood neurogenesis is the method used to preserve donated brain tissue. For the older study, scientists examined 59 samples, some of which were drawn from brain banks where they had been kept in fixative paraformaldehyde for an extended period of time. This paraformaldehyde can turn cells into gel, thereby discouraging binding with the double cortin protein that researchers rely on to gauge neuron development. Crucially, the team behind the new study found that levels of double cortin protein is brain tissue experience a sharp decline within just 48 hours of being immersed in paraformaldehyde. Waiting 6 months, Dr. Lorenz Martin observes, and neuron detection becomes almost impossible. The Madrid researchers relied on donated brain tissue processed within 10 hours of death and soaked in preservatives for no longer than 24 hours. The youngest test subject, a neurologically healthy 43-year-old, yielded about 42,000 immature neurons per square millimeter of tissue. Comparatively, the oldest donors had some 30% fewer newly produced neurons. Those with Alzheimer's had 30% fewer immature neurons than healthy donors of the same age. Michael Bonaghidi, a stem cell biologist at the University of Southern California, who was not involved in the study, says that the paper is a technical tour de force that overcomes the issues raised by last year's study. But Sean Sorrells, a neuroscientist at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, who co-authored the 2018 paper, says he and his colleagues did not find the evidence for ongoing production of new neurons convincing. It's possible, he says, that the immature neurons spotted by the team were actually present since childhood, and the double cortine protein also shows up in mature cells. It's unlikely this latest study will settle the debate once and for all, but the paper does hold promising implications for Alzheimer's treatment. If neuroscientists can figure out a way to detect newly formed cells in living humans, they may be able to diagnose the disease in its earliest stages. This could not be applied to advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease. But if we could act at earlier stages where mobility is not yet compromised, who knows, maybe we could slow down or prevent some of the loss of plasticity in the brain, says Dr. Lorenz Martin. And again, that article was from the Smithsonian. .com, and the author was Maylene, M-E-I-L-A-N, Solly, S-O-L-L-Y, who is a Washington, D.C.-based arts and science journalist. Our last article today on the Healthy Living Program is by Gretchen Reynolds. She wrote this in the New York Times on March 20th, 2019. The title, Why Lifting Weights Can Be So Potent for Aging Well. Weight training by older people may build not only strength and muscle mass, but also motivation and confidence, potentially spurring them to continue exercising, according to an interesting new study of the emotional impacts of lifting weight. The findings intimate that people worried that they might be too old or inept to start resistance training should perhaps try it to see how their bodies and minds respond. We already have plenty of evidence, of course, that weight training can help us to age well. By our early 40s, most of us are losing muscle mass at a rate of about 5% a decade, with a decline often precipitating a long slide toward frailty and dependence. But older people who lift weights can slow or reverse that descent, studies show. In multiple experiments, older people who start to lift weights typically gain muscle mass and strength, as well as better mobility, mental sharpness, and metabolic health. But lifting helps only those who try it, and statistics indicate that barely 17% of older Americans regularly lift weights. So, as part of a larger study of weight training and the elderly, scientists at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland recently decided to see if they could discover how weight training changes the minds as well as the musculature of people who had not done it before. To start, they turned to 81 older men and women who were part of their health database and who had agreed to begin resistance training. These volunteers were all between the ages of 65 and 75. Like many Finns, healthy and physically active. But they did not lift weights. For the full study, they began a twice-weekly program of supervised full-body resistance training at the university to familiarize participants with proper technique and build a base of strength. After 3 months, the group was randomly assigned to continue training once, twice, or three times a week, while a separate, untrained group served as controls. Periodically, the researchers checked the volunteers' strength, fitness, and metabolic health, and also their attitudes about the workouts, including whether they found them daunting or inviting, and how difficult it was for the volunteers to find the time and resolve to show up. This routine lasted for 6 months, by which time the people lifting weights had almost all gained strength and improved various markers of their health, even if they had lifted only once a week. But then, after the months of supervised lifting, the exercisers abruptly were on their own. The researchers explained that they could no longer have access to the university facilities and provided them with information about low-cost, suitable gyms in the area. But any subsequent training would be at their own volition. The researchers waited 6 months and then contacted the volunteers to see who was still lifting and how often. They repeated those interviews after an additional 6 months. They found, to their surprise, that a year after the formal study had ended, almost half of the volunteers still were lifting weights at least once a week. "We had estimated a rate of 30%, says Tia Kekalainen, a project researcher at the University of Jyväskylä, who led the psychological study with the senior author Simon Walker and others. Also surprising, the researchers discovered little direct correlation between muscle and motivation. The people who had gained the most strength or muscle mass during the study were not necessarily those most likely to stick to the training. Instead, it was those who had come to feel most competent in the gym. If someone's self-efficacy, which is a measure of confidence, had risen substantially during the study, he or she usually kept lifting. In effect, people who discovered that they enjoyed and felt capable of completing a weight training session subsequently sought out and joined a new gym and showed up for workouts despite no longer receiving nudges from the researchers or encouragement and companionship from their fellow volunteers. They found out, the researchers said, that resistance training is their cup of tea. Most of them also told the researchers that weight training had provided them with renewed confidence in their physical abilities beyond the gym. They could do things that they thought they could not do before. Of course, about half of the volunteers had told her and the other researchers that they preferred other types of exercise. And those men and women, for the most part, no longer lifted weights. The scientists hope in future studies to explore the issues of what drew some people to the lifting and left others uninspired, and how weight training routines might be structured to appeal to the skeptical. For now, people interested in starting to lift weights should look for classes or trainers specializing in beginners and learn to lift safely. But the overarching lesson of the study is that to discover how you feel about weight training, you need to get out and try weight training. Thank you for listening to today's Healthy Living. If you have questions or comments, call 210-829-4223. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Martha T. saying goodbye.